Hello, this is Carl Weinschenk for the Daily Music Break, which is at www.dailymusicbreak.com. Please check out the site for lots of good music across the spectrum and free email newsletters. Thanks for listening to this podcast. We are going to talk about the great and unique guitarist John Fahey with Richie Unterberger. Richie is the author of 8 books, including profiles of the Velvet Underground, The Who, and others. Richie, welcome, and thanks for joining us. Please fill us in a little more completely on what you've written and where the listeners can find it.
For about the last 15 years, I've written books on rock music history. Besides the ones you mentioned, I did a 2-volume history of how folk and rock music merged in the 1960s, and I've done a couple of books about overlooked cult rock acts. And you can find out about these on my website, richieunterberger.com. And I'm also in the process of putting out expanded ebook editions of some of the titles, and a couple of them are out now. They're for sale on the usual big distributors.
Great. Well, that sounds like a lot of very interesting stuff. I'd like to talk to you about some of the great unknown acts, and maybe we could do that in the future. Sounds really cool, actually.
Yeah, definitely.
Okay, now to talk about John Fahey. Broadly speaking, Richie, who was John Fahey for people who might not be that familiar with him?
John Fahey was a folk guitarist, but I think what makes him very interesting is that he kind of expanded what we might think of as a folk guitarist. He picked up a lot of influences from traditional American folk music and rural blues, but he added a lot of himself and kind of modified or expanded the form, might be a better word, so that it was almost experimental. It covered so much unusual ground using those influences as a base. He started his career as a performer in the late 1950s when he was very young, but the bulk of the work that has been most influential, certainly, and I think the best, was done in the 1960s and about the first half of the 1970s. He put out many records, and another innovative aspect of his career, I think, is that he often put out the records on his own, or with a little help from other people, but that kind of ensured that there was artistic independence for this material that didn't have much counterpart in what other musicians were doing at that time.
Mm-hmm. There are lots of fabulous guitar players out there, Richie. Somehow, Fahey seems different. In your profile at All Music, which is great, you use the term eerie strangeness. And I think it's a great description of Fahey. How do you see it? There just seems to be something that's always been different about John Fahey.
When you listen to a lot of his music, not everything he recorded, but I think the music that's most affecting, there is a lot of similarity to other acoustic folk guitarists in his skill, his virtuosity, but it has a sense of often dissonance or melancholy or unexpected tangents that are very hard to define. I mean, I did my best with that adjective, but it does seem kind of like when you're listening to it, you're in kind of these big open spaces, but they're not like really idyllic fields with nature and grass and butterflies. There's like always these storms threatening or these dark clouds coming over the horizon. There's almost like a very restless feel, I think, to a lot of John Fahey's music that keeps you on edge and you don't know exactly what's coming next. And that's why I personally, at least, return to that more than I do maybe some more conventional acoustic guitarists who I think melodically and structurally are working with more predictable forms.
Mm-hmm. I'm skipping ahead here in the list of questions I sent you, and I apologize for that. But it's pretty apparent from your profile and from anything you read about Fahey is that he had a pretty troubled life, especially at the end. He dealt with Epstein-Barr, diabetes, alcohol problems. He was married 3 times. He was indigent. Is there a connection to you between that and kind of the nature of the music?
I think so. I think after the 1970s, there's not much music of note that he did. And actually, the music from the final stage of his career, when he didn't just start to focus on electric music, but on very grating, almost industrial music, I think, A, it wasn't that good, but B, it was so dissimilar to what he had done that a lot of fans, even if they were interested in knowing that he was active again, when they heard the stuff he was doing, they weren't very impressed or interested in following what he was doing. I do think that the quality of the music was also kind of becoming less impressive, even independent of his quite severe personal problems. Maybe he was running out of things to say. You know, he was so prolific between, mm-hmm. say, the late 50s and the late 70s. I don't know exactly how many albums. I think there must have been at least 20. And they were almost exclusively instrumental.
Mm-hmm.
It's hard to, in that format, when you're not working with songs with lyrics, keep doing stuff that sounds new, fresh, and different without repeating yourself. And mm-hmm. it's possible that it would have been very hard for him to come up with records that were as striking as his best ones from mm-hmm. the 1960s. I mean, he did go into something very different when he went really electric. I just don't think it was very good.
Mm-hmm. So you combine that with the personal problems, and it kind of tells a story, I guess.
Yeah, and it's a very unfortunate story if you read the recent book that came out about him on Chicago Review Press. There are a lot of details. It's hard to believe this guy, who'd been very successful for an independent record maker,
mm-hmm.
His circumstances could change so drastically that he was like living in Fleabag hotels, going from room to room, mm-hmm. and had a really hard time even meeting his basic subsistence needs. And that had to have affected the music, even if he'd wanted to keep playing,
sure.
and recording.
Sure. Skipping back to the beginning, I'm sorry I'm skipping around so much. What influence or what impact did, and what was the importance of Charlie Patton, the blues player, on Fahey and his, I guess, the beginning of his career?
I think that blues players like Charlie Patton, we're talking about country blues guitarists who recorded in the early days of the record industry before World War II. When he heard musicians like Charlie Patton, he realized that there was material, music that was part of America that was barely acknowledged by mainstream culture, that was really interesting and really different from anything that he had been exposed to growing up in suburban Maryland, mm-hmm. kind of near D.C. And I think that helped him form an identity. The music was so different, and it affected him in ways that he never felt possible by music. He wanted to do something similar that was as distinct, but do it with his own voice. If you listen to early Fahey recordings especially, some of them are quite derivative of country blues. It might sound like he's trying to play like Charlie Patton or some other musicians from that time. Very quickly, it evolved into something more personal.
Mm-hmm.
There were other musicians besides Charlie Patton. We're talking about African-American early blues guitarists whom he felt this way about. But he probably felt most strongly about Charlie Patton because when he went to UCLA to do graduate work in musicology, he actually wrote a thesis on Charlie Patton, and it was published as a book, and he was involved in the final years of his life in assembling a huge and definitive Charlie Patton box set. If you asked him, I don't know if he would say, yeah, that was the number one blues guy for me, but I bet that it was, considering how much effort he put into documenting his life.
Bucca White was also important from what I read in the profiles.
The which was important? I'm sorry.
Bucca White.
Oh yeah, Bucca White was also important, and I should also say, even though Charlie Patton died a long time before John Fahey heard his music, hearing this long gone music that you couldn't get easily. Right. This is like the 1950s and early 1960s, also sparked John Fahey's interest in finding the surviving practitioners of this style, like Bucca White, whom he found, he rediscovered. And John Fahey and some other blues enthusiasts, young white guys, were crucial in rediscovering these surviving blues musicians who often hadn't recorded for 30 years or so, and helping to revive their careers, but also importantly, radically expanding awareness of their music, which in turn influenced a lot of contemporary music being made in the second half of the 20th century.
So it's almost like Alan Lomax. I mean, they were going out and finding these guys. Today, you know, people our age, we're probably about the same age, just take it for granted that those old blues guys, you can get record albums or CDs or whatever. Even see them on YouTube, that didn't have to happen. And people like John Fahey were important in bridging that and bringing those people back. Very important thing.
Yeah, they were crucial. And at that time, we're talking the early to mid-1960s, it was not just really unusual, but even risky for white guys to go into the South and find these musicians and bring them back to visibility, because with racial tension at such a high point during that era, they were viewed with suspicion by both whites and blacks, actually, for wanting to interact on a personal level with these elderly African Americans. Mm-hmm. And John Fahey was even taking risks, even before this, when he was just trying to find these records, which had not been reissued. He would go to poor African American neighborhoods, go door to door, and actually asked, do you have any old records? I'm interested in buying them from you. And that was also, you know, not a comfortable situation, both for him or a lot of the people that he was trying to buy records from, because contact between the races in those neighborhoods was so limited. So it took some courage, too.
Mm-hmm. He, and one of the things you said in the profile, and the other profiles said, and you said it earlier in this interview, is that he integrated a lot of things into his music, not just the old blues, but things that very, you know, out of the ordinary for a guitar player to be playing and for it to all be put together. So I guess that's one of the things that really made him different than the other players.
Yeah. Besides the blues and maybe like Appalachian folk music, he never talked much about that, but I think because where he grew up was rather close to that area, I think he absorbed some of that too. I think that you hear in his music, it's hard to account fully for how this came into what he was doing, but there's an influence from the avant-garde, from contemporary classical music, some of the effects that he would use, some of the tape manipulation, editing stuff and recombining them, sometimes running it backwards. And also, on some of his records, I think there's an influence from jazz, both from early 20th century jazz. When he recorded for Warner Brothers, he even did stuff in the Dixieland jazz vein. And also, I'm not sure how conscious he was of this, but you hear some similarity between him and improvising jazz musicians of a later time, where I don't know if he was a fan of people like John Coltrane or Ornette Coleman, but I see a similarity in that he takes a style as Coltrane and Coleman and others took jazz and makes it something quite different by spontaneously improvising. And for some people who vary the traditional forms of folk music or jazz music, they found it very upsetting because it was so energetic and at times almost violent in its execution. But it was very different, and it was something that expressed something of Fahey's personality that had to come out that traditional folk music could not accommodate.
Very, very interesting how his what was going on for him personally got funneled into the music. It's you know, and that might, you know, account for a lot of the eerie nature of it. I think it's pretty good bet. I was pretty surprised to read about the connection between Fahey and the band Canned Heat. Usually think of those two in the same sentence, but he was friendly with the guitar player. I think it was Alan Wilson from Canned Heat. Is that what happened?
It's not that unexpected when you look into the history of the founders of Canned Heat and John Fahey. The common bond which got these guys to meet and become friends was that they were such enthusiasts for old-time blues, country blues, and they were fanatical record collectors of this style. So Al Wilson and also Bob Pike, the singer from Canned Heat, they were among the leading collectors of this kind of material. And also, this is an important connection, John Fahey, as I mentioned, was studying or doing graduate work in musicology at UCLA. And through those activities, he became friendly with Barry Hanson, who was better known as Dr. Demento, the radio personality, another fanatical collector of music of all kinds, but definitely of old blues, too. So in this circle in Los Angeles, John Fahey came to know all these blues enthusiasts. It must have been, you know, back in 64, 65, there couldn't have been that many people who were seriously collecting this. But they did include those two early members of Canned Heat, Al Wilson and Bob Pike. And Al Wilson helped John Fahey with some of his graduate work because Fahey had to do kind of a rigorous thesis. And Al Wilson has some knowledge that was helpful in kind of helping to construct that piece of work. There are specific details in that new book by Steve Lowenthal about John Fahey. But that's why these guys knew each other well. And it seems like Fahey might have even been in Canned Heat, but John Fahey never, until the final years of his life, was enthusiastic about playing electric music. And Canned Heat, from the get-go, they wanted to take country blues, but they wanted to electrify it. Of course, they did that famously on some of their hit records, like On the Road Again. But Fahey didn't want to be a part of that. I've read different accounts. It seems like Fahey might have even been in Canned Heat, like even on a rehearsal level very early on. This is like 1965. Other accounts don't mention that he actually formally played with them. But it wouldn't surprise me if it was at least considered that he would, but he might have backed out very early, realizing that they wanted to do electric blues and that wasn't his thing.
It's pretty interesting. Along the same timeline, Fahey actually started Tacoma Records. And there's a long history to Tacoma Records. And probably the most famous early Tacoma Records artist was Leo Kottke, who's also a fabulous guitarist. Did they have a personal relationship that you know of, Kottke and Fahey? Or was it more of just a professional, you know, that was Kottke's first label?
They did seem to be friends, and besides recording for Tacoma, they worked together. Kottke did some work for Tacoma Records. I think John Fahey realized, well, this guy's doing some stuff that is similar to me, but he's different enough that we're not going to be real heavy competitors. We're not going to be conflicting with each other. There's room for both of us. And Leo Kottke, I think it's fair to say, his music's more accessible. I'm not putting him down for that.
Right.
But it's going to have always wider appeal, even within the folk audience and to a larger audience. And Leo Kottke did not have the personal problems that John Fahey did, as far as we know, which is another reason he was able to build a much more commercial career, which still sustaining, you know, for a really long time. It seems like the relationship was kind of between personal and professional. Like, they were friends, but I don't know if John Fahey really had that many personal close friends at all. And it was professional in that the association helped each of them. And I don't know of much, if any, bad blood between these guys. I mean, no one seemed to get along with Fahey for a really long time anyway, but it seemed to work out pretty well for them.
Mm-hmm. And to bring it full circle, the last years, as we've touched on already, were, you know, it just seemed to really, you know, was the end of the story wasn't very happy, and it's just unfortunate. And Fahey passed away 4 or 5 years ago?
It was actually longer than that. It was more like the early 2000s.
Mm-hmm. And it was just the alcohol took over? Or was it just his body gave out finally?
It was more of his body giving out. He was in his early 60s, and he'd been in poor health for quite a while, say like the last 15 years of his life, in part because he kept pretty poor personal habits, didn't take care of himself or exercise or eat well and all of that stuff. And eventually he went into the hospital for some surgery, and he died with complications from that. And it did seem like a matter of, even though he was getting some more money at that point from an inheritance and greater recognition, he wasn't going to last that much longer, even if he'd been able to pull through from that, because the general stress of his health problems and emotional problems, I think, had just weakened his system a lot by that point.
It's funny, as we're getting towards the end of the interview, I'm thinking that if I had to listen to two things from Fahey, you know, the only ones I would be allowed to listen to, it's the Of Rivers and Religion album, which is a slow album and, you know, not nearly as fast guitar playing or as technically, you know, provocative, I guess, from a layman's point of view. And also this very slow version he did of the song Sea of Love, the Phil Phillips song. I mean, there's just something about his music that's just very compelling, you know. Mm-hmm. I'm always amazed when I listen to him.
Do you want me to comment on that?
Yeah, I guess. It's not really a question.
Yeah.
I
will say that I think something that's real impressive about John Fahey's records, I never saw him in person, mm-hmm. is that at least, say, for the first 15 years when he was recording, the late 50s to the mid-1970s, it's a very large body of work, and it's very diverse, even if it's all or mostly within the acoustic guitar format. The recordings I like of his, actually, I don't know if a lot of Fahey fans would share this opinion, but the ones that are kind of the strangest, where he does some stuff unexpectedly. He adds some different instrumentation, maybe from flute. He does those tape manipulations that I had talked about before, or he just plays stuff that is really strange. Some of it's still coming out. There was a box set of his rarest recordings that came out on Dust to Digital just about a couple of years ago, and that has some very interesting material as well. And it's stuff that's just not very comparable to anything from the time in which he was working or in other eras.
Mm-hmm. It's an amazing legacy. Richie, I'd like to thank you very, very much for taking time out. I'm totally serious that I'd like to talk to you in the future about some of the unknown rock acts that you've written about and that you've researched. And in terms of this interview, again, I'd like to thank you very, very much. It's been fascinating.
Thank you very much, Carl.
Okay, take care.
Thanks.